Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
The following podcast contains explicit language.
Hello and welcome to the Disney World edition of Slate Money, your guide to the business and finance news of the week. I'm Felix Salmon of Fusion. Anna Szymanski is here. Jordan Weissman of Slate is here.
Yep. Hello.
And I wanted to do this thing where I was like, welcome to the business and finance news of 10 years ago, because right now is one of those weeks where everyone is like, it's 10 years since the beginning of the financial crisis. But there have been many beginnings of the financial crisis. And I feel like maybe BNP Paribas subprime fund freezing redemptions is not the only or even main beginning of the financial crisis. So let us know on slatemoney@slate.com. Number one, when do you think the financial crisis really happened? Like, when did it really kick into gear? When was the big day? And number two, is this something we should even be talking about 10 years later?
Can I just say that September 15th, the day Lehman Brothers fell, I had been on vacation for a week. And I came back, I opened the door to the office, and one of the guys I work with was on the floor throwing papers up in the air and was like, welcome back.
That's
true story.
That's amazing.
I was in Las Vegas at a blogging convention with Jim Ledbetter, who just launched this website for Slate called The Big Money. And we both kind of looked at each other and said, we should be anywhere except for in Vegas, right? we are not going to talk about the financial crisis this week. We will probably talk about it at some point in 2018 or possibly 2017, depending on when it would make sense. We are going to talk about lots of Disney.
Yes.
Because there was a lawsuit Disney settled, and they have pulled their stuff from Netflix, and I am going to tell you a secret about, well, it's not a very big secret, about Disney HQ, where I have been, because I briefly kind of sort of not really worked for Disney. I feel like the place to begin is $177 million.
Yes.
Which is... Anna, what is $177 million? We're going to start with, it's not even a numbers round, it's just a number.
That appears to be the amount that Disney had to pay to settle the lawsuit with BPI.
They paid more.
Right.
So that's the amount that it cost Disney. We'll come to the total amount of the lawsuit in a minute. But what or who is BPI?
It's a Beef Products
Inc.
Inc.
Yes, Beef Products Inc.
And BPI, Beef Products Inc., does basically exactly what it says on the tin, and they make
beef products.
Beef products, or what did they call it? Lean textured beef.
Finely textured beef protein.
Finely textured.
Which beef I had protein. To write down because I couldn't remember.
AKA
pink slime.
Pink slime. And people have been writing about pink slime for a while, and ABC, which is a television network, which is a subsidiary of Disney, did a whole story about this pink slime on the television.
Series of stories, yeah. And they kind of went on a crusade about it and maybe went a little over the top.
And
perhaps.
And BPI, and these stories were indubitably damaging to BPI. They were also indubitably factually correct. There was the stories are still up on the website. There has been no corrections, and no one, as far as I can tell, has been able to point to any statements of fact in these stories which have not stood up.
Yeah, I mean, I'm starting to vacillate on that a little bit. So the issue here is that, again, so there's we should actually explain what this product is, right? Mm-hmm. Because I don't think everyone's been on, like, not everyone's been hanging on to every detail of this case. But so it's basically beef trimmings. It is real meat. It's kind of the stuff left over.
It comes from a cow. Anyway.
Yeah.
I wouldn't quite go so far as to call it real meat.
I mean, it's meat.
Well,
it's beef muscle.
I mean, it's beef trimmings.
Yeah.
It's ammoniated beef trimmings. Yeah.
Which means they won't have bacteria.
Do you know how much stuff in our meat, yeah, like in our meat system that gets treated with ammonia? Like, that is
pretty much everything.
Yeah. I mean, chickens, like all sorts of things. Or I think chickens maybe get chlorine or some shit. But anyway, like, I mean, it is beef trimmings, and it goes through a process where they essentially throw it around a
centrifuge.
Thank you. A centrifuge. I had a moment there. They put in a centrifuge to remove the fat to make it leaner. And that's where you get the lean beef product, whatever. And so this was an okay. And then they figured out how to clean it, how to kill off all the microbes.
By throwing ammonia all over it.
Well, no, ammoniated gas. But it's to get rid of the E. coli, so you don't die from your hamburger. And so...
And then they put it into hamburgers.
Yeah, so like a lot of ground beef that you were buying in a grocery store had this product in it that was, you know, lean, finely textured beef product. And so most people didn't know that because it wasn't labeled. And there was this one very angry USDA scientist who decided this stuff was not meat and it did not belong in ground beef. And he wrote a memo calling it pink slime. So that it came from an actual USDA scientist with an axe to grind who really, he just had philosophical oppositions to this stuff. And ABC really took that and ran with it and used the phrase pink slime apparently 137 times. And then it created this, you know, it created sort of a consumer's movement to get this stuff out of hamburgers and out of school lunches.
Right. And the effect on BPI was certainly negative. Like, BPI wound up selling a lot less pink slime because people didn't want pink slime in their...
Three of their plants closed, like 700 people lost their jobs. And also, it's important to point out, there is not actually anything wrong with this product in the idea, in the sense that it doesn't hurt you in any way.
Right. But then again, there was nothing in the ABC reports which said that it did.
Except to keep calling it pink slime over and over.
Well, so this is the thing. Exactly. They called it slime has a meaning.
Yeah. To say that people wouldn't assume your product is disgusting when you call it slime over and over and over again is ridiculous.
It is disgusting. It's just not unsafe. And they didn't say it was unsafe. They said it was pink slime, which is a thing that it was referred to as. And the upshot of all of this is that BPI loses a bunch of money and then sues ABC and Disney, saying, you put out these reports and we lost money. Now, for me, I would say, well, that is how journalism works. You know, you surface true information, you put the true information out to the public reacts to the true information, the world changes according to the public reaction, and then, you know, three cheers for journalism. The BPI, on the other hand, is basically saying, you can't do journalism if it causes us any damage, and we want $5.4 billion, please.
Yes, and so here's why, like I say, I'm a little bit torn about this, because what they did is they went and sued in North Dakota because they're based there, 20 miles from where their plants were. And North Dakota's Trump country, among other things, which we, you know, at Trump wasn't an issue when they first sued. But this is a part of the world that is, or a part of the country that's not particularly friendly to the media. They were very much on their home turf. And they went to trial with it. And midway through the trial, I guess ABC saw the writing on the wall and decided it's time to settle for, you know, $177 million, at least that's what they're paying, and then probably their insurers are paying more, it appears. And so I'm a little frustrated because, on the one hand, this is apparently a story that ABC still stands by. They have not taken it down. They have not corrected it. They've not done anything to it.
There is nothing wrong with the story.
And yet they have decided to settle for $177 million.
Let's stop saying $177 million. They have settled for substantially more than $177 million.
At least $177 million. And probably more, or definitely more than that. We just don't know exactly how much more. And so, to me, their decision to bow out of a case for a story they still stand by puts a huge target on the backs of basically all media. I really hate the way ABC has handled this. I don't know if they, you know, it's hard for, again, I feel like their reporting was over the top, and using the phrase pink slime over and over again I think to some extent, it kind of created a false impression that this wasn't beef. Like, that's kind of fundamentally.
And they had
it.
Someone in one of the episodes say, most people wouldn't consider this meat.
Yes, exactly. Yeah. But
Me too. I'm part of most people.
And I don't know, maybe. But like, it's still, they stood by it and then they settled the case for a ton of money. And so that sends a message to every would-be litigant, every angry business that a deep-pocketed entertainment company that even if it is a viable target for a lawsuit can be intimidated, can be shook down, even if they wrote a story that they think is true. And so that is disturbing to me, that part of it.
And so number one, truth really ought to be an absolute defense in these kind of cases. Number two, and as it should have been an absolute defense in the case which brought down Gawker Media Group, you know, when Hulk Hogan sued them for saying something true about him, and then it basically destroyed the whole company, and destroyed the whole company for a sum much lower than $177 million.
Well, it wasn't a defamation case. We can argue
that
was
an invasion of privacy case. But the point was, in neither case was there any dispute over the facts of the matter. And if the facts are true, you should be able to report them. But much, much more importantly than that is that if you are a company which commits journalism, you should, and especially if you're a company which commits journalism and you have the size and the liquidity and the resources that Disney has, then you should totally defend that journalism rather than rolling over and settling cases. There was much talk before this case went to trial of it being appealed all the way up to the Supreme Court. There was a huge number of people who expected that the sort of anti-media North Dakota jury would find against Disney and that Disney would appeal and then they might win on appeal and then it would get appealed by BPI. And this was just the first step in a long series of appeals and cases and stuff. And so this idea that Disney settled because they suddenly thought that the jury was going to find against them, just that doesn't ring true to me. That was never the idea that like the jury verdict was going to be the end of it.
And also perhaps in this instance, they didn't have a great case. Like, I don't disagree with you that I do think this is disturbing in terms of what it could mean moving forward for journalism. I completely agree with that, especially in this environment. Completely agree with that. Having said that, I don't think this story by ABC was particularly responsible journalism.
But that is not the bar, okay? You cannot say that every single piece of journalism needs to be found particularly responsible by a jury in North Dakota, otherwise you should lose $177 million. That is not how freedom of speech and the Constitution works. We have the right to say things even if they're not responsible.
Well, actually, at some point, there is reckless disregard for the truth. Like that is the standard.
That was not argued.
Well, no.
No one was arguing.
No, they were arguing.
They were arguing that. And again, I don't fundamentally disagree, but I also do think this case, like if you look at the details of the reporting, for them to argue that the ABC story didn't suggest that this was an unsafe product, that this was a product that no one should use, that is exactly what it did, and it caused irreparable harm, and there wasn't anything unsafe about the product. I realize they didn't come out and explicitly say this product is unsafe, but when everything in the context of the show is to suggest that, that's a little tough.
I mean, number one, there was clearly not reckless disregard for the truth. This entire series was lawyered up to the eyeballs before it came out. There was nothing in there which anyone claimed to be untrue. The one thing which ABC clearly had was huge respect for the truth, and they wanted to make sure and nail down every single assertion that they made.
Except they kept calling it slime.
So if really all they cared about was telling the public that this product is in their meat, why didn't they just say, finely textured beef protein, a like ammoniated beef product, is in your meat? Because the reason they didn't say that is because obviously no one's going to listen to that story. We all know that.
Right.
People will listen to a story that says pink slime.
Right.
Yeah. So
what's wrong with that? Why not make the story that people want to listen to if the story that people want to listen to is true?
Well, because, again, and this actually is part of the lawsuit, is that, like, you describe something as slime, that literally the textbook definition is, like, a liquid. Like, it's, right. like, not a, like, when you say slime, you're imagining something, like, that sort of
it's
seeps.
It's slimy.
It's-ish. I mean, it's finely tech. It's like what you get if you put a fine ground sausage. It's probably
right.
The,
if you look you at know? Any type of processed meat, it's kind of gross.
Yeah, I mean, it just like
right.
to me.
And
I'm not,
I feel like the
I'm angry.
The general public has a right to know that a lot of processed meat is kind of gross. This is a true
fact. Do people not know that? Do people think that the meat that's in a lot of like these products is fantastic and doesn't include? Things that
I think
they probably
a lot. I think Americans
eating?
In general are good at not thinking about that kind of thing, and then when you force them to look at it, you're like, they're like, "Ooh, that's kind of gross," and that's good. We're learning things, wait,
so, but it looks gross. It yes. wasn't. I didn't actually have any negative qualities in terms of safety.
Wait, but so, no one said it did.
Felix, I'm trying to figure out who you're mad at exactly.
So, I'm mad at Disney for settling the case.
Yes, I'm mad at Disney too. We agree on that. That especially because they stood by their story. If they hadn't stood by their story, then God knows. But. It's bizarre to what they have done in this case is very bizarre to me. Are you mad? But who are you mad at the way the law is structured? Are you mad at the company?
We don't know how the law is structured because it never got appealed. We never heard the arguments. And yeah, I actually have faith in the American jurisprudence system. And I think that if they had had the courage of their convictions, they would have wound up having to pay nothing.
Okay. Okay, I see. So you're just pissed that Disney did not have the courage of its convictions to take this all the way.
And
the
I think,
field.
And you know, ultimately, I worry that Disney is not a news organization. It's a large multinational entertainment conglomerate and doesn't really care about journalism.
Yeah, I think that's probably true. Like it's not, and to them it was in the end I'm guessing they made a cost benefit or yeah. You know they made a risk assessment and said what are the chances that we lose this case even on appeal mm-hmm. and what are the chances as a result we get stuck with a billion plus judgment from a bunch of crazy North Dakotan jurors and they said that chance is worth that probability is too high for us to continue this case rather even if we support this story. I imagine that was the conversation. I don't know for sure.
I would certainly imagine that the decision to settle the case was made over the objections of anyone at ABC, that this was a decision made at like the Disney level.
Probably,
they're saying, you know, we can settle for $177 million. We can bury this in a 10Q footnote. No one's going to notice it. Whoops. They noticed it.
Turns out.
You know, if we do that, we have a 100% chance of losing $177 million, but then we also have a 0% chance of losing $1 billion, and that's worth it.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
Which I just think is not the way that any respectable news organization should ever behave.
I think I agree with I'm just going to push back on that a tiny bit because in the case of a news organization that actually could face an existential threat from a $1 billion judgment, I do think that there is some responsibility to not go out of business if you can afford help it. Disney did not have that concern here. Disney, again, this is what pisses me off so much is even if it had been a $1 billion judgment, Disney could have survived it. Like this is not a they are one of the few companies that should be in a position to defend journalistic ideals. And as you're saying, they clearly are not.
Apple Card is the perfect cash back rewards credit card. You earn up to 3% daily cash on every purchase every day. That's 3% on your favorite products at Apple, 2% on all other Apple Card with Apple Pay purchases, and 1% on anything you buy with your titanium Apple Card or virtual card number. Visit apple.co/cardcalculator to see how much you can earn. Apple Card issued by Goldman Sachs Bank USA, Salt Lake City branch. Subject to credit approval. Terms apply.
So let's stick with Disney because they actually put out press releases rather than just burying things in the footnote of their earnings report. They're very big on streaming services all of a sudden. And one of the things which you don't really think about very much when you're on Netflix is trying to work out who the copyright owners are for all of the various different
I know that's all I'm thinking about
that you're watching. You know, there's a bunch of movies, there's a bunch of TV shows. At the beginning of the movies and the TV shows, there's some long list of producers, most of whom you've never heard of, and none of which is actually relevant to who owns the copyright. And now what has happened is that Disney, who does own the copyright to a certain subset of that content, has decided that they are no longer going to license it to Netflix because they are going to set up their own rival streaming service and put it on that instead. And like, my first reaction to this is like, oh my God, do I really need to try and work out who the copyright owner is when I'm trying to watch something on my Apple TV? But it's not about me. It's all about Disney trying to make money.
Yeah. I mean, this is a little bit frightening. If you were the kind of person who was hoping you were going to be able to get away with, cutting the cable cord, this is a big step towards just like the total fragmentation of not just cable, but of the streaming services themselves. I mean, you know, Disney is the world's biggest entertainment company. It's the Marvel movies. It's Star Wars movies. It's the Disney Channel. It's just so much content. It's ESPN. Yeah. And so, you know, the fact that they're saying, okay, we're going to have our own little gated, streaming service, for our shows, for our movies, and you're only going to be getting it if you pay us directly. It seems like this is the beginning of basically not being able to save any money by cutting the
cable
cord.
Right. I mean, it could eventually become much more expensive because now that streaming technology has improved, and also now that consumers are used to watching television in this way, it makes total sense that a lot of these content producers are going to say, well, why am I giving this to Netflix? Why don't I just have my own service?
Yeah, and this is, one of the reasons why Netflix itself is banking so hard on its own original content turning itself into a streaming HBO because they know they might not be able to rely on other content providers.
Okay, so this bit where like it could turn into something which theoretically perhaps might become more expensive than the cable bill is not something which worries me.
Okay.
Because for most people it won't, right? For most people you'll have one or two or three or four things which you're paying, $7 or $8 or $9 or $15 a month for. And even then, you're still not up at cable bill levels. And the point is there that what you are doing is you're actually paying for stuff you want to watch, unlike cable, where you are paying for a huge amount of stuff you don't want to watch. And I feel like everyone who's ever dreamed of an a la carte, pay only for what you want to see system, like their utopia is arriving.
I don't know, Felix. Like, there's a lot of stuff on cable you don't think you want to watch, but then you tune into Naked and Afraid for the first time, and you're like, wait a second, they knew I wanted this before I knew I wanted it.
I do think that the age of the big bundle is probably ending, and essentially cable companies are just going to become internet companies.
Yeah.
But I do think the idea that you're only going to have one or two of these, I don't know. I think that, honestly, I have not paid a cable bill in a long time because I haven't had cable in many years. So I don't even know what cable costs. But if you start to add it up, I don't know. I guess to me, the what I think is also interesting is in terms of what this means for Netflix future. Because I think Netflix is in a very bad position compared to many of its now competitors.
And I'm weirdly slightly more sanguine about this. The Netflix business model when it first started streaming stuff never made any sense to me, because what you had was Netflix would pay a bunch of money to license content,
yeah,
and then it would sell subscriptions, and the only way it could sell subscriptions would be if it paid whatever the content copyright owners wanted to charge. And ultimately, they would always charge Netflix more than Netflix could make in subscriptions, because there was nothing stopping them from just raising the price. And Netflix had to pay whatever they were being asked to pay, because that was the only place they were getting content. Now, in the new world of Netflix buying They just signed a big deal with the guy who did Kick-Ass, you know,
yeah, Miller.
Yeah, they actually bought a comic book.
Yeah, they own a bunch of Marvel TV shows, which they get to keep now, even though Marvel is part of Disney. They are making a bunch of original content. What that does is it gives them finally a little bit of negotiating leverage with the content, with the copyright owners, and saying they can say, you know what, if you want to go off and put Star Wars on its own streaming channel, you go ahead and do that because we have other places we can get content. In fact, we can just make it ourselves.
People are still going to watch Jessica Jones.
Is that making that type of original content is quite expensive. And if you look at Netflix's last earnings statements, everybody talked about the top line revenue growth or subscriber growth. But if you actually looked, they took on a lot more debt. They also are eating up their cash. And because they're taking on more debt, that means they're also paying more in interest payments. Their pre-tax income is down. Their model doesn't make sense until at some point they can really increase prices, because they have no other sources of revenue, as opposed to some of these other more established companies that do.
Well, okay, so this is actually interesting, because now they've bought a comics company, and now they are making movies which have theatrical releases. They are beginning to branch out into alternative revenue sources. Like, they are getting theatrical revenue from movies. They are selling comic books. They are doing, you know, other things which bring in revenue. These are very nascent. And you're absolutely right that if you're looking at, you know, this quarter's earnings or last quarter's earnings or the current balance sheet, yeah, things don't look good for Netflix. But then again, they almost never have. Like, Netflix has never had amazing earnings. The question is whether they can get somewhere powerful and important in the future, you know, as the slogan has it, whether they can become HBO before HBO becomes Netflix. And I think that this announcement from Disney is weirdly a ratification of their model, and we are going to find ourselves increasingly in a world where ESPN has its own streaming channel, Disney's going to have a non-ESPN channel, we're going to have the HBO Go, we're going to have the Netflix, and people are going to pick and choose. And Netflix got there first, it has a first mover advantage. Is that going to make it, is that going to justify its current crazy market cap? Now, you can argue about
not
that.
Not even a little
but,
bit.
But like,
200 P ratio.
But I think the idea that on some level this is actually a sustainable business is now something which is believed not only by Disney, but by many, many other companies as well. I mean, not only by Netflix.
Doing this as part of a larger business strategy is sustainable. Doing only this, we still don't know if that's sustainable.
Felix's point, I think, is that they are in the early stages of moving on beyond just having the streaming channel. They are hoping to look a little bit more like Disney,
right?
You know, a little.
Yeah. At one point, people were saying they want to be HBO, and now they're saying they want to be Disney.
Right, but they're going to have to get there by taking on a lot more debt and spending a lot more money in the way that their other competitors are not, and that's where I think they're not in the greatest position.
Hello, I'm Imi Harper. On the Slow Newscast from Tortoise, I tell the story of how a Hong Kong billionaire was silenced.
I got bombs thrown into my house. I got people came here, ransacked my computer. And I got people fractured me. I got this and that, but I'm safe.
And what it reveals about the freedoms Hong Kong no longer enjoys. Listen to Hong Kong's Rebel Billionaire on the Slow Newscast, wherever you get your podcasts.
So, yeah, this show
does
not give investment advice.
No.
Yes. But, yeah, no, we can agree that probably Netflix looks like a kind of terrifying equity play. But there's more to businesses than equity. There's also things like the broader stakeholder and employee experience that we talked a little bit about last week when we were talking about
B-Corp. Quite a segue.
And there's also things like how happy are your employees when they come into work, and do they have, you know, Stumptown cold brew coffee on tap and this kind of
thing?
This
is the key to Felix's happiness.
This is basically the key to Felix's happiness. What's one of the most interesting little baby stories which came up this week on John Gruber's podcast is the experience of Apple's employees in their amazing new $5 billion headquarters in Cupertino, California, where the obviously, Apple is not trying to economize here in terms of like spending less money. They're not trying to squeeze as many people as possible into a small office because the rents are so high. You know, money was basically no object on this HQ. And yet what has happened is that a bunch of Apple employees have wound up in open plan offices, which by all accounts they don't much like, and in fact often are refusing to move into the new headquarters because they prefer the old offices.
Yeah, they're just working at, these are just like highly, highly paid engineers working at long tables one after another, which I kind of like. It's democratizing. They have to deal with like their annoying coworkers the same way we bloggers do. Like,
we had this, you know, we saw this with Goldman Sachs when it moved its headquarters from Broad Street over to West Street in Lower Manhattan, that suddenly, thousands of people who used to have offices no longer had offices and they were unhappy about this.
But also like the traditional trading floor model is also open seating.
Yeah, I was going to say that made a little bit more sense with Goldman Sachs because that was like the, you know, that is the image of the bond trading floor.
No, but like I think this is important. A trading floor needs to be big and open. A trading floor has always been big and open. And then you have a bunch of investment bankers who have no need for big and open trading floors and who aren't traders. And suddenly they find themselves in these like open plan offices with, you know, phone booths you can go into when you need to make a private conversation and all of this kind of stuff that we're all living in these days. And they're like, no, this is horrible. It was much nicer when I had an office.
You see, I've never had an office. I've only known the world of cubicles and open floor plans. And so I just don't see it. I don't know. Is it really? Felix, have you gone from an office to an open floor? Anna? Like,
so, yeah, I mean, I actually have. And I know, like, because my last job was the first job that I had that was, again, it was a trading floor setup. And I'll be perfectly honest, when I first went there, I was kind of like, I'm not sure about this. Also, we were in a little bit of an interim place, so my boss sat like 4 inches from me, and I'm not exaggerating. So that was a little close. But when we moved into our better arrangement, I actually liked it because it really does create a sense of camaraderie, and you always have rooms you can go to. So if you have to do certain type of work, you can do it there. But it's also great for information flow. I actually wouldn't want to go back. I really liked it.
So to bring this back to Disney,
sorry.
The thing which fascinates me about Disney is I've been to Disney's headquarters in Burbank, California. And I mean, it's an amazing piece of architecture. There, it's this huge, big colonnaded building with 7 columns along the front, and each column is in the shape of a dwarf, like Snow White and the 7 Dwarves. Okay. And you walk in, and there's all of these amazing stills from Snow White and from Fantasia. There's, you know, Star Wars bits and pieces. There's it, and it is the classic sort of carpeted offices, you know, where like secretaries have their own separate offices outside the other offices, where you have to go through layers and layers of gatekeepers before you meet the important people. And just the amount of square feet per person is probably larger than the typical Manhattan apartment.
isn't that like, that's very much like entertainment industry, right? Like old school entertainment is about like giving, like creating an aura of authority and just like power around the executives. And like, you can't do that if you're all in a bullpen together, right? Like it just, that's not, I mean, maybe you can, I don't know. But yeah, to me, that seems like that's just a part of the culture industry that like is not going to ever have people, you know, producers are not going to be working at long tables. You can't like curse wildly at someone on the phone while you're all sitting together in a room.
Well, I think you can and you do. And I've seen a bunch of like television production setups where that is exactly what happens. But it's kind of interesting to me that like Disney spent $7.4 billion buying Pixar from Steve Jobs. And when that happened, you basically had this like very big, lumbering old school entertainment company adopting the methods of this much more sort of Northern California tech-based company. And it's an interesting fight. And I feel like in a weird way, Apple has got out a little bit too far in front of its skis, that when employees don't like working in a certain way, and I think most people who've had offices and have worked in open plan offices, ultimately they like the idea of having their own space. And every time that anyone's tried to create, you know, a cool, sexy, modern, hot desking situation, it never really works very well. That if you want to really do well by your employees, which is clearly what the intention was when in the new Apple campus, then you should listen to how they want to work. And they don't want to work this way.
Although I don't know. Like this report, I would also say, like, there weren't a lot of details in this.
And yeah, but it rings true.
It rings true, but that doesn't...
So this report said there were like certain teams, certainly.
Vast majority of people, I imagine, are working in the new setup, which would then suggest that they're okay with it.
No, that doesn't suggest that
they're
okay
with it.
It just
means they didn't have enough heft at the company to get their own building.
Yeah.
That's certainly possible. I do think also everybody hates change. So you are almost always moving from what was older, which was cubicles and offices, into what is newer, which is open seating. And I agree, there have been lots of studies that show that open seating isn't as great as everybody thinks it is. And there's probably certainly some truth to that. But I do think for certain types of work, it makes sense. For other types, it doesn't.
Wait, so I have a question. When I was reading this, is Apple's headquarters... By open seating, are we talking about just like actually you sit down wherever the hell you want on any given day?
You have pods. It's very convoluted.
Okay.
But like within pods, you know, you're working in close proximity in an open floor plan to other members of what is presumably your team.
Okay.
Right. Because I do think it's important for people to have their own space.
Yeah.
I think that I do think it's important, but I don't know. And I also think that I believe there's also been some work done that shows that younger people are actually more okay with working in this way.
I mean, that's because that's all we've known.
Right. That goes back to my whole idea where I think some of this also has to do with just change.
And I mean, the thing which I've noticed is, well, there are two big things that I've noticed in open seating systems. One is that you see a huge number of people who are just constantly working with headphones on. It's like this way of cutting yourself off from the people around you as much as you can. The headphone has become like the universal
do not disturb sign.
And like, that's not an efficient way of doing that, especially for people like me who don't actually like wearing headphones. And then the other thing that I've seen is a huge move from like large amounts of screen real estate and people having like two or three monitors in front of them to people just working on laptops. And I think that the reason for that, again, is like a privacy thing, that if you have a whopping great big screen in front of you and you're part of an open plan office, everyone can see what you are working on, which is also weirdly uncomfortable. And so people like hunch over their laptops, again, for privacy more than for convenience.
Ergonomically,
I feel like people
also
are trying to build little bits of privacy in where like they are. Well, while the architects are trying to design them out, and I think it's important, and it shouldn't be designed out.
I think that the jury is still out on whether open seating is going to ultimately be a net positive or net negative, but I don't think it is as negative as you were making it out to be.
What's the argument for it being a net positive? I think there's a lot of utopian crap about how like it helps in terms of communication.
It does. It really does. I'm sorry. There are certain, like when I worked very close to the trader and
you're working on the trading floor, we understand the trading floor.
And I realize that is a unique example, but I imagine that is not the only example.
It helps in journalism, you're
like shooting ideas back and forth with your coworkers.
Yeah, and I've also been at other places where they do not have this setup, and frankly, people don't stay on task. You look at a lot of computers and you see a lot of online shopping. So I'm not saying that is the only other thing that happens, but I do think this, I realize you can be distracted on the one hand, but it can also keep you on task on the other. Again, I think there's a push and pull.
Numbers round. Anna, I'm going to go first this week because this is my favorite. This is an Anna number. And I want to make sure I get in there early so that you don't steal my number.
Okay.
It's $775 billion, which was earlier this week the official market capitalization of Mercantile Servicios Financieros, which is a Venezuelan bank.
Oh.
The most valuable public company in the world was actually a Venezuelan bank, and the official stock market capitalization of the Venezuelan stock market was something like $3.4 trillion, which is more than the stock market capitalization of the entire German stock market. This all, of course, having
curious
to
how
do
they calculated that
with the official exchange rate. Right.
I was going to say, like, I'm pretty sure I can see where this is going.
If you use the sort of unofficial black market exchange rate, then things start making a lot more sense. But that is what happens when you have like artificial exchange rates. You get weird artifacts like a $775 billion Venezuelan bank.
Is it my turn?
Yes.
My number is 42. That's how high the VIX rose during the 2011 debt ceiling crisis, when it wasn't clear if Congress was going to actually, you know, pay its bills. And the
VIX, remember, is a measure of stock market volatility. Yes. It has nothing really to do with the bond market.
No, but so the VIX, it's often referred to as just like the fear gauge, right? It's just like when people don't know what the fuck is going on in the world, the VIX goes up, or that's supposed to be how it works. Currently, it's at 15. And I've been just asking people, why is just given how dysfunctional our politics are right now, and the fact that in September, Congress is going to have to try and raise the debt ceiling, and we really don't know if they're going to be successful at it, why more people aren't betting on the VIX just shooting the hell up, given that we have very recent precedent for
this. We've had like entire segments on like why is volatility low?
No, but like
market.
This right now.
But I'm wondering, how long did the VIX stay at that elevated rate?
Was number one, it wasn't there very long, and number two, of all the things to cause stock market volatility, I feel like a debt ceiling crisis is probably not it. Like, I can see why it would cause volatility in short-dated treasury bills, but why would it affect how much you want to pay for Apple stock?
Because the concern is that once the U.S. breaches the debt ceiling, like, no one knows what's true and what works anymore. Like, just all of a sudden, the right. U.S. treasuries are no longer...
It's just uncertainty.
Yeah, we don't... You no longer is the good faith and credit of the U.S. government a certainty in this world.
Well, I see. And then again, I feel like we learned a lesson the last time around. What you had, weirdly, and people didn't expect this, but this is what happened, and it kind of makes sense ex post, is that you had a flight to quality trade, that people were afraid about, you know... what this meant for assets, and they wound up selling risky assets like stocks and buying safe assets like treasury bills. And this is the one thing which you have to remember about the debt ceiling, is that ultimately the United States is going to pay those bills. And even if it defaults, which it probably won't. It probably won't default on treasury bills. And even if it does default on treasury bills, it will still wind up paying, you know, all of that in principal and interest, plus probably statutory interest at 7%, which is much higher than you could get normally. And there's no real risk of you losing any money if you buy treasury bills. And I feel like in that sense, the kind of, oh my God, a US government default would be the end of the world scenario is a little bit less scary than it used to be, although it's still pretty scary.
Yeah, I mean, I'm still scared shitless of it.
since we're on this subject, and you're the politics person here,
yeah.
I always thought the problem with the debt ceiling
was
that, you know, the Republicans
that
wanted to do mean things like to the Democratic administration.
Yeah.
If the government just brings forward a bill saying raise the debt ceiling, the Democrats will all vote for it. You'll have a handful of Republicans voting for it, and then it will pass. Why is this not going
to
happen?
Because there are still a lot of Republicans who want to attach it to cuts, and there are questions about the administration's position, because the Office of Management and Budget Director, Mick Mulvaney, is someone who really, during the last debt ceiling crisis, he was agitating for not raising it without cuts. He really, really wants to attach reductions in mandatory spending to this bill. And from what some people have read, his view is kind of prevailing in the White House right now, and weirdly may even have the support of Gary Cohn, which is really unexpected to me. So whereas Steve Mnuchin is sitting there going, just raise the goddamn debt ceiling. So the internal dynamics of the Trump administration are really bizarre here. No one really knows. And also, it's unclear, you know, if Paul Ryan is really going to want to have to rely on Democratic votes for this sort of thing. You know, John Boehner obviously was willing to do that back in the day. Ryan already feels his hold on power is sort of getting flimsy. So, it seems like he's worried about that. So it's, you know.
So are you saying that
there's
if
a
push
lot of,
came to shove,
yeah.
Paul Ryan would not introduce a bill which could only get passed on the basis of having a lot of Democrats?
I think he would. I think just the issue is that there are a lot of, there's even more uncertainty and like kind of potential disaster points, potential, you know, that are that than in the past. There's especially given the giant question marking over what the hell the White House thinks.
Right. So, yeah. It's like there'll probably be a lot of sound and fury and then they'll eventually raise it. But again, we've in the past year just seen things we've never anticipated seeing. So that does raise concerns. But the market does not appear to have those concerns.
My theory, as I say, is that it's entirely possible that those concerns are priced in, and that the effect of the debt ceiling not passing on the market would actually be much lower than people fear. But what's your number, Anna?
My number is $350 trillion.
That's possibly the largest dollar number we've ever had on
the show. So that's the amount of money connected to derivatives.
It's a notional amount.
Yes.
It's not a real amount. It's a notional amount.
Fair enough. So this is the amount of money that's tied to, with derivatives, loans, and mortgages tied to LIBOR. And I'm bringing this up because I've been wanting to, for a few weeks, just mention the fact that LIBOR is going to be phased out. Which
I'll believe it when I see it.
Yeah, it's going to be a slow process, and it's not like it's just going away in 2021. It's just they aren't required to post it. But this is a huge part of the market, and we at this point really don't know what's going to replace it. And it looks like there's also the possibility that we'll move into a much more fractured market in terms of multiple different reference rates. And I don't know if that's good or bad, but it's definitely going to be different.
Felix has a allergy to LIBOR. I just like that right now. I can see the hives like slowly rising from. I don't blame him for it. It's like Is LIBOR you've talked about?
Part of the reason that they're doing away with it is because it was based. I mean, it wasn't supposed to be based on these survey results. It was supposed to be based on like transactions. But then because it became based on survey results, it was so easy to manipulate.
Yeah.
And, you know, we've obviously had a lot of those scandals.
So, if LIBOR goes away, that'll be great. If LIBOR doesn't go away, nothing will change. If something else comes along, fine. Again, this is something I'm finding it difficult to really care about.
Well, I was going to say, concretely, given that this rate was already sort of manipulated and wasn't real to begin with in a lot of ways, as a homeowner, do I have to care about this?
No, you really don't.
Probably not. I'll probably not. I'm just saying it's the end of an era.
Okay.
It's not necessarily a good era, but it's the end of an era.
Okay.
Okay, well, I think that's it for us this week. Thank you for listening to Slate Money. Listen also to Trumpcast, which is hosted by Virginia Heffernan and Jamel Bowie and the chairman of Slate himself, Mr. Jacob Weisberg, 3 times a week, Monday, Wednesday, and Friday. Apparently, there's news about Trump. Who knew? So you can listen to that as often as you like. Find that at slate.com/Trumpcast. If you want more content about the President of the United States. For everyone else, subscribe to us, listen to Trumpcast, write to us on slatemoney@slate.com. Thank Dan Schrader for producing because he does a great job. And we will talk to you next week on Slate Money.
Hi-ho, hi-ho, it's home from Earth we go.